You're listening to the Final Issue Podcast, a comic book industry conversation show. Each week, a panel of comic creators will tackle current hot-button industry news, as well as discuss the most vexing issues aspiring and professional creators face when building a career in comics. On the panel today, we have
Joe Mulvey, freelance illustrator and graphic designer.
Dwayne Peastrom, comic book writer and creator.
I am Aram Bart, creator and producer of the God's Fall podcast.
We've got issues, so let's get right to them.
Issue number one. Welcome back, finalists. We have a extra special guest this week. I'd say it's not the host, it's the game master of one of my hands-down favorite D&D podcast, real-time game, whatever they're called. They'll always share so many different names, but we have... If I'm going to say his last name wrong, I apologize already. It's Aram Vartian.
Yeah, that was actually right. Well done.
Okay, I listened to like six different podcasts that you were on to see how everyone else was saying your names and did a consensus. Okay, most people said it like this. So,
yep. Yes. I used to get a lot of Aram Vartian in the Navy. So,
Aram?
Yeah, I know that people have listened to the show now because they can pronounce my name. That's how I know.
At least your first name, for sure, yeah.
Right, exactly.
Yes, Aram is the host of the... Dungeon Master. Do you go Dungeon Master or Game Master? I don't even notice.
I go by DM, like DM Aram normally. You know what I mean? Because it just seems like the normal way to refer to it.
Sure.
I don't go by the proper whole Dungeon Master. Yeah.
You don't have, because it makes it sound like you have a cape and stuff on.
Right, exactly.
Which we're not denying that you do.
Sure.
But...
I mean, it's possible. It is possible. That said, when I was looking for other fellow gay Dungeon Masters, when I was first doing this, like trying to find a sense of community, that Google search term really turns up a very vibrant community, but it's not the one I was looking for.
See, gotta have that safe search on. Always have the safe search on.
Yes, you do.
All right, yes. Aram runs the game God's Fall, and I've mentioned it on this show before. If you follow me on Twitter or Facebook, I mention every time there's a new episode, I always talk about how much I love it. So it's to me an absolute thrill to have him on to talk a little about his show and then have him actually on our show to talk about our stuff. So awesome. For the people who have been denying me and not following my advice, what is God's Fall for everyone who doesn't know what it is?
God's Fall, you know, well, what God's Fall really is me as a DM being sick of players getting to like fifth or sixth level and then making a beeline for the largest city they could find so they can take their amassed gold and buy every magical item they can get their hands on so they can get a bunch of plus ones. That's what God's Fall really is about. That's the underlying reason why I did what I did.
Okay.
What the story is, there's a world where there were these gods and they all got into a gigantic war because mankind became so enamored with their own ability to cast magic and their own power that they turned inward and they birthed the god of man. And that upset the entire balance, caused a giant war that lasted about an hour. Everyone died. Magic died. The entire world was consumed in this world storm, and the last dying act of the god of man was to erect a barrier to protect the small central eye of this storm from being wiped out as well. And that's where, well, 98 years after that is where the game begins, in this fragile little eye of the storm.
Cool. And now you guys are all local to Washington where you live, so that's kind of cool to be. I mean, like, most of my podcasting or gaming experience has always been online. Like, I've never met any of the hosts of the show. Anyone I've ever D&D'd with has always been online, so I've never met them in person. So actually having the experience of them in person has got to be take it up a notch.
It's funny how many people have that experience now. I stepped away from D&D for about a decade because my last experiences running games were so traumatic and awful that I just honestly abandoned it. And when I came back, I hadn't seen Roll20. I didn't see any of this. So it really did surprise me how much it shifted, because I never even considered playing something like D&D anywhere except for around the same table. That's just, I mean, I've been playing for over 30 years and that's just how I always did it. I have since then played a couple of Roll20 games and really enjoyed them. But to do what I do, we all have to be in the same room.
Yeah, definitely. Now, are all the players in your game, are they all friends of yours, or friends of friends type thing? Or, I mean, how are you guys all connected?
I knew everyone except for the most recent two. So Steven and Kelly were people that I just threw out and said, hey, you want to come play D&D with us? And they came and we met them that way. Michael, I have known since high school. Doug, I have known since he was 19, and he joined a vampire game, actually, that Michael was running at the time. And Kay, I know because she lives in the same apartment building I do.
Oh, awesome. That is so cool.
Same. Yeah. So it's a call in a variety. And then we have a new player, Joe, who I met through, actually, I was helping a local very cool project called Tech Garden with their Kickstarter video. And he worked with them, so I met him, and he was dying to play a D&D game. So that's how he got roped in.
Oh, very cool, very cool. Yeah. Now, do you ever play? I mean, you're the DM for this one. Are you going to be playing in – I know – Doug is doing a game soon?
Oh, I've already been playing in Doug's.
Actually, okay. Yeah.
We've been we did a little bit of playtesting that. We've recorded the first game of that, actually, and we're going to get about the idea with that one is to get – we've learned our lesson from God's Fall. We're going to get 10 recorded, edited, and done before the thing's even launched. I mean, we're going to get ahead for once.
Very – that's awesome. Yeah.
And so, plus, I want to use it as an opportunity to teach Doug how to edit so that he's knocking out shows as well, and I'm just coming in helping him polish up the top. That way we can keep getting more content out.
Oh, nice. Very cool. So what is your – I mean, do you prefer – I mean, obviously, it seems like you prefer the DM, or do you prefer playing? Do you just DM because you're the storyteller of the group?
I prefer to DM when I have a story that I can't get out of my head. And God's Fall was a story that I refused to leave my head. And it had been something I'd attempted to do twice and failed at. And it was gnawing at me. So as long as I got a story to tell, I want a DM. But otherwise, I love being a player.
Oh, definitely. And right now, I mean, when this episode comes out, your Kickstarter will have ended. But you have been you've been successful with your Kickstarter. So congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, we were successful halfway through the third day, which is awesome.
Yeah. So, yeah, but if not, I mean, now is there going to be any opportunity for people, like when they hear this, they're all going to want to listen to your podcast and want the world book. Is there going to be an opportunity to get the world book after the Kickstarter?
Absolutely. Once once the Kickstarter has ended and the first books have shipped, and we expect those to go out probably the beginning of January, if not a little earlier, but I'm not sure how tight that's going to be, but definitely January. Once those have gone out, and I know that everyone's got them, I'm going to open the books up for a print on demand from anyone who wants them.
Very cool. I've been listening to that. I think I jumped on. I mean, I don't even remember how I found the podcast. I think maybe One Shot put it on Twitter or something, or some jazz like that. And I think I've been listening for since episode 2 or 3, because I remember listening to the introductions, and just your introduction episodes were so well produced. I'm like, good Lord, this is an amazing show.
I took a risk with that. I wasn't sure if that was going to work out, so I'm really glad people responded well.
Well, it's kind of like how the comics do for movies. They do those little one issue things for the movie that's coming out to introduce a character or something like that. So it was kind of like that, a little, hey, the show's coming on, get to love this character before we even dive into it.
Well, I mean, I love so many actual play podcasts, but there were so many of them that at the beginning literally just dumped you cold into a room where people were talking.
Yeah.
And you got to figure out who's who. Mm-hmm. And I was like, this doesn't work for me. I need to be introduced to each individual so I can get to know them, and then I can expand the cast. And that was the idea of why we did it that way.
Oh, yeah. I listened to probably a half dozen different live game shows. And I have gone out of my way to either email or hit them up on Twitter saying, hey, you guys should really throw in who's playing what character and a recap at the beginning, because you come out every 2 weeks. I don't remember what happened 2 weeks ago because I listened to 7 other shows. I don't want to have to go back and listen and say, hey, just, my 2 cents. Give me 30 seconds last week on. That way,
Absolutely. Who's who? What did you do last time? Reorient me. Let's go.
Because it's since we're comic books, it's like comics. Every episode could be someone's first episode. So you want to go in with that.
Last time on God's Fall. Yeah, you got to do it. Yeah, right.
Exactly. Yeah. So, okay. Now, if people wanted to, now they're all excited, where would they find God's Fall on the interwebs?
You can, because for some reason it was free. Find God's Fall at godsfall.com. Just straight up godsfall.com. GODSFALL.com.
And you are on Twitter as yourself, but if they want to talk to you about the game, unfortunately, you didn't get God's Fall on Twitter. Somehow that didn't
happen. No, there's just some young kid who has it for some reason. But no, we're God's Fall DC on Twitter.
Okay, so there you go. So after listening to this, go talk to Rami. It seems like you answer almost everyone who talks to you, so it's pretty impressive.
I'm on Twitter an awful lot, and I never was on Twitter before. Like, this is my first kind of real foray onto it. So it's but people have been very cool,
Yeah,
I'm there.
if you have an itch or you remember playing D&D when you're younger and you haven't got around to it, or like me, I don't have as much time to play as I would like, you can live vicariously through the Godsfall crew. Go check it out. I highly, highly recommend. Issue number 2. The last couple episodes we've been talking about Captain America. When Captain America 1 came out, everyone lost their mind because apparently he's a Nazi. Now issue 2 comes out, everybody lost their mind because they were lying to us. And if you follow Nick Spencer on Twitter, really if you follow any main 2 writer, seems more than the artist, always seems the writers to get it on Twitter. Anytime there's a storyline people don't agree with, they get attacked. And Nick Spencer and I'd say Dan Slott are the two biggest ones I notice who will go after their trolls. People will, and will go back and forth them over and over again. And to me, it's funny for a little bit, but then it's like after like 4 days, I can't imagine what the mindset of Nick and Dan are after dealing with that kind of negativity all the time. And I just wonder, to ask the panelists here, is it worth engaging with the trolls? Should we feed the trolls or just mute them and move on? I mean, what do you guys think?
I'm sorry, go ahead, Ron.
No. But I mean, I think engage. I think engage for a couple of reasons. I think engage because, well, honestly, engage because take a couple hits. Because as far as I'm concerned, the internet is one toxic sludge pit for women. It is one unbelievably scary, awful place for women. And if you're a dude and you should push back, period. Always. You should always let that voice be known at least a little bit. And if nothing else, just engage the asshole for a while and give someone else a break, you know? So I always feel like pushing back. But this is personal for us because they came after one of our players.
Yeah,
so,
I couldn't believe that. Yeah.
Yeah.
I listened to the episode and I didn't even think anything of it. She made a little comment. If you haven't listened to the episode, the second or third episode where you do one of the introductions.
It was the third episode, yep.
Yeah, was a female player, and it was about a dress and how the dress was the focus because she was a female. And Aram addressed it, and all of a sudden, I couldn't believe you got negative comments about that. And that, like, blew my mind. I said, like, that's such a trivial thing that it didn't even, like, blip on my radar as something that pissed people off.
Yeah, and in that same episode, I actually make a real strong crack against first-person shooters and then actually take a little aside to tell the audience that I love video games and please don't hate me because I thought that's what was going to get me in trouble.
Yeah.
I had no idea. We didn't see it coming at all. And then the incredible just fury over the fact that we had a 5-minute talk about sometimes women get stereotyped in fantasy. Literally, that's what we did. And then she went on to describe this dress in such loving detail, you would have think she was a designer, you know? So it was exactly what you want a role player to do, and certainly what you'd want any first time role player to do. This was her very first time she'd ever played. She had questions, you know? I mean, it boggled my mind. So no, I mean, always push back. Because they claim too much ground, they intimidate people, they make people feel afraid to tell stories and to be safe within spaces where they should be safe. Because fantasy, for God's sake, should be for everyone. So always push back. But that's my opinion.
Sure. Joe?
But I have a question. Do you think that the people's opinions matter? Like, that's, I've said this on the show a million times.
Yeah.
Sorry,
I don't think their opinions matter. Like, I don't, like, you know what I'm saying? I'll go into a room of people, and as long as I leave with my wife still loving me, I could give a flying fuck what anyone in that room thinks. I treat the internet the same way. Like, the only problem and the only reason I think I would engage, one, is I have not engaged in so many Twitter feuds because I know that the temptation is there, but I feel like, kind of like an Ultron AI, the trolls have this way of rolling with every punch to turn it into you're the wrong person. That, you know what I'm saying? Like, they're the kind of person that if you got shot, they would blame you for being offensive to the bullet.
Yes, that's true.
And I think that within that, like, I'd like to engage with the sense of, like, answering the question of why can't we have different opinions? And why does a different opinion vilify one side and glorify another? Because, like, I've been a witness to, we all have, these Twitter feuds where someone has an opinion on something, so then it turns into their opinion's invalid, they have white privilege, they should be banned, they shouldn't have jobs, they shouldn't have this, they shouldn't have that. Like, they take it to the point of, like, not only saying you're not allowed to have your opinion, but your opinion should defy the fact that you should make money, be able to support yourself or your family. Like, they take it to a very bad place, whereas there's always great room for dissent. I'm a great debater, and I don't try to cut this. Debater. Nothing else. I like to debate things with buddies and friends, be it sports, comics, movies, and I enjoy getting a different point of view that might be something that can affect me in a good or a negative way. You know, like, I'm sure we've all had conversations where we go, oh, I love this movie, and then someone goes, really? You could deal with this story point? And then you think of that, and you're like, oh, wow, that does kind of ruin it a bit for me. Or you kind of go back and forth, and I think there's something lost now where you can't have that back and forth. It's immediately, if you don't like something, you're anti something instead of just not liking it. And I do not engage as much as I would like, because I just fucking have shit to do, man. Like, you know, like let's just run off a quick rundown of what has been the big thing right now. The big thing is Brian Michael Bendis not being a good boy, right? That's a big thing coming up right now.
Well, yeah, he's neither black or a woman, so people are mad that he's writing a 15-year-old black girl as Iron Man, yeah.
Right, and before that we had Nick Spencer with Iron Man, Captain America.
Yeah, Dan Slott's always yelling with somebody about something, so yeah.
Well, I swear to God, him and Rich Johnson must sneak away to a log cabin on the weekends and just open a bottle of wine and laugh, because you know they're literally like the Abbott and Costello. They need to have a reality show where the two of them travel from con to con. I would pay money to see that.
We got to kickstart that. We got to do that.
I really like Michael, and I think he's an excellent story. So I think this will be a great book. I think there's also a conversation to be had, though, about black characters being written by black authors. I mean, there is a dearth of black authors in mm-hmm. all of the comic industry. Their voices don't get heard as much. So I think I think there's an argument to be made on this. I think Michael's an excellent writer, and I think that it'll be very well taken care of in his hands. But I just I think that there's I can understand the point of view where it's like, let us tell our own stories. Mm-hmm. You know,
have the character out there than not, though. Sure. Like, I feel like there's still an underrepresentation issue. But yeah, I don't engage because I'm afraid. I have written a couple of pieces that were very personal and very hard for me to write. And I don't want to debate that with somebody who just wants to make my day bad, because they don't actually want to. If they thought my point of view had any validity, they wouldn't be saying the things they are. I'm starting from I'm starting from a different place on that, I guess.
But do you even hear, Sam, how Aram started that? I think there's a discussion to be had. Yeah. That's what a normal, well-balanced human being would decide to say. Yeah, I think there's a discussion here. Not, you know, vilifying the guy who has the job. Like, you know what I mean? Like, there becomes a point of, like, absolutely. Like, I fall, like, very much on the side of, with most arguments, let the work speak for itself, right? Like, sure. The Nick Spencer thing. Like, Nick Spencer deserves death threats because he did all that stuff. That's ludicrous.
Absolutely.
Ludicrous. Like, you know, and now Brian Michael Bendis is part of the problem. I don't think he's part of the problem. I think, you know what I'm saying? If the big thing of diversity gets spoken of a lot in comics, and, you know, I think, and my opinion is just one of a billion, I think no matter what, you could be any race, gender, sales is what is king, mm-hmm. right? So
that's true.
If you sell, the companies don't care. They don't have an agenda to they just want that book to make money. Like, now this isn't creator-owned comics where there's more of a personal touch that goes into stuff where I could see the creator mattering more. I really think that no matter who writes the new Iron Man book, it's going to get its bit of controversy, and it's going to get, you know, its bit of press. But I mean, you know, like with Miss Marvel being Muslim, that was a thing like a while ago, right? Like, mm-hmm. who cares? The book sells, and it has related to so many kids, right? Like, what does America
She's
have?
She's an amazing character. Absolutely. Yeah.
Amazing book.
Yeah.
I bought it for my niece, and she loved it. And I can't wait for more, and wants a Miss Marvel shirt. Like, there's something to the story connecting and all that kind of stuff, I think, that just matters more than vilifying a creator. Like, just make the book good, and I think from that alone you can do a lot. Like, okay, I had this conversation the other day about this. Actually, it's today, Thursday, so Wednesday I had this conversation in the comic shop about how people are saying, well, you know, oh, there's no, like, I can't name a black female writer. And I'm like, yeah, it's true. There's definitely not a wide amount of them, you know. And then someone goes, oh, I can't name a black artist. I said, well, then you're crazy. Because, I mean, you know that Black Panther book over there that's immaculately drawn by Brian Stillfries, mm-hmm. who's been a master mm-hmm. for 20 years? Mm-hmm. Yep. That guy's black. But I don't see – I just see the product.
Yeah.
Sure. You know what I'm saying? I think you just got to make that product – you know, again, I'm talking in circles. But, I mean
– No, I get it. But
circles are your favorite.
Let me say this. As a gay man, if I see other, when I was younger especially, to see other creators, to see other influencers, to see other people, and to be able to go, I see myself, I see my stories, I see my path. I can relate to a whole bunch of stories. I love stories. I grew up on tons of stories that didn't need to be gay. I'm just saying that when you did see that one, when it was there, it was so affirming and so amazing. And if it's a good story on top of it, can be so unbelievably compelling on a different level. It's just, I feel really strongly that there just needs to be room for everyone. And I think we all agree on that. There just needs to be more room for, you know, ideally there'd just be room for more voices, but there's a cost. I worked in the print industry for 14 years. Paper isn't getting less expensive. I mean, ink isn't getting less expensive, but shipping isn't getting less expensive. All of these costs are going up. So it is difficult.
Now, in my brain with the trolls, and I understand, like, Aram, what you're saying about how you shouldn't shy away from the challenge per se, but to an extent, what's the point? I've like gone through and like followed the whole conversation that Nick and Dan and them have had with these people. It's like, there's no point. It's no. Like debating physics with a kindergartner. It's you're not going to get anywhere. What I mean,
people don't want to have their minds changed.
So then why engage? Why spend 2 hours talking to, you know, ChuckleFan37 on Twitter about why you're not really a racist and you're trying to explain to him what you're trying to do if ChuckleFan is never going to change his mind?
Well, I'm not going to give anyone 2 hours, first of all.
Well, no, I
mean, no one gets 2 hours from me. But I hear what you're saying.
I even engage 5 minutes. You know, you have a podcast that needs to be edited down, so 5 minutes, the show comes out faster. I'm being a selfish fan. But, you know, why waste 5 minutes of your time that you could be with a loved one? You could be having a meal, watching something on Netflix with someone who's not going to change your mind. You might as well talk to your cats. What's the
point? I hear what you're saying, but there's other eyes on those voices. It's not, if it was just me and him in a room and no one else was looking at it. But the internet consists of 90% of people who don't post, who just read. So if the 10% of people are posting, aren't pushing back, then whose voices are those 90% of people reading? And that's who I'm worried about. You know what I mean?
I think that's a very valid point.
I
have had this argument a lot because I do not engage, like, as a matter of principle. I would rather say what I have to say in long form and get it out there and go on. Because the arguments against what I have to say in particular, like, are so, like, impossible for me to even comprehend to respond to in an intelligent way. Like, when people are like, oh, there's no sexism in comics, I'm like, I don't even know where to start with that. Yeah. Like, you're living in a different world than I am, and I can't, like, if you can look at what's out there and you can look at the way women in the industry, you know, come out every few years and are like, by the way, I was sexually harassed and had to put up with all this shit and people wouldn't let me write these books and whatever. Or, you know, like, when you can look at the data and still assert that didn't happen. Or, like, recently I had a bunch of crap come at me because somebody quoted a piece that I had done on The Killing Joke a year ago. And so things came to me again from that. And they're like, I don't understand how you can say that Barbara Gordon was sexually assaulted in The Killing Joke.
Right.
And I'm like, but it's on the page.
It's on the page. It's right there.
You're looking at it.
Yeah.
Like, and it's just like, you're just dismissing so much in order to make your point, you are ignoring all the evidence that's already there. There is nothing I can provide beyond what exists to make you admit it. And I think that that may be a niche thing. And I also think that I'm just kind of like afraid of people. Like I'm kind of, I don't know. No,
That is valid. There are people on the internet that is worth being afraid of.
Yeah.
That is a valid fear to have.
Yeah, but I guess that comes to Aram's point that, you know, maybe you engage with that troll for someone like Sam who may not be comfortable or the confidence to engage with the darker side of Twitter and Facebook. That maybe...
Oh, I'm definitely talking from my privilege when I say engage. Okay. So let me underline that. Like, I recognize as a man, you know, I'm talking with a lot of privilege when I say engage. If you don't feel comfortable engaging, there is a nice little block button. That button, if that button existed in real life.
I am familiar with the block button. Like, I really do just block everybody.
Block, 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 block. If I could do that in real life, what a world this would be.
This is a quiet, happy place.
I do that in real life, but, you know.
just put the headphones on and go for a walk.
Yeah.
So. You know what? There's a guy on Saturday Night Live. I forget who it is. It's the guy who does the weekend update. I can't think
of Oliver. No, I'm sorry.
John Oliver.
I think it's the guy who does the really good impersonations. He does like Denzel Washington. I saw him on like, I think it was Jimmy Fallon or something like a little while ago. And someone commented like, you always engage with all these people that like insult you or whatever. And his thing was, I treat Twitter like it's a video game. Like, it's not real. Like, it's an RPG. Like, I just treat it with enjoyment, and I say what I want, and I just don't care.
That's awesome.
You know, and I get how there's a little bit of an irresponsibility to that, but at the same time, you know, and I'm a different person. I'm a handsome, husky, white male from Queens, New York, who you know, has gotten into fights since you've grown up as a kid. I think once you've been hit in the face with a bat, you kind of shake off the cobwebs of, like, oh, someone said something bad about me online. Like, it doesn't correlate, but then I do speak to people who get literally shook by what people say, and I used to be very, like, dismissive about it. Like, how could you care what someone says? But I think in the dismissiveness of that, there's a slight bit of truth. I pull back a little bit on how much I would kind of say, oh, there's no need to it, but I can understand the effectiveness that other people can have over others with even just using their words. But the sincere thing is, like, not everyone's going to like you. Not everyone's going to like your opinion. Like Aram said, the internet is a cesspool of just absolute dump. And, you know, if you allow yourself, regardless if you engage or not, if you allow yourself to be easily hurt or swayed by what strangers say who might not even understand the situation or even have a conversation in mind rather than just I feel like being a social justice warrior today, or I feel like being an asshole today. You know, like, I think at the end of the day, you can engage, you can push back, but make it worthwhile, because otherwise you're losing a lot of time. You could be watching Netflix. You know what I mean? There's a lot of other things you could be doing.
Catching Pokemon. I've spent a lot of time catching Pokemon in the last couple of days.
And like, to be clear, I'm not afraid of like what anyone would say about me. That's okay. Sure. Like people are going to say that whether or not I engage. I'm afraid of like getting someone's interest up to the point that they go after me in a meaningful, lasting, personal way. Yeah. You know, like, I don't want like somebody hacking my phone and posting pictures. I don't want somebody putting pictures of my kids up or anything like that. Like, I feel like there's a line there between my internet life and my real life, and I want to keep that line firmly in place, and I'm afraid that feeding the trolls will erode that line. If I'm not just somebody that comes out of the woodwork to talk on a podcast or, you know, like, occasionally post things on Twitter or write an article. You know, like, if I become somebody that is actively engaging in some kind of figure for something, and I become like a fun person for the men's rights activists to go after, I don't want that to happen, because they're ruthless and awful. And I'm pretty sure that's who would hate me most.
Yeah. Have people done that?
What?
Oh.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. There's been people, they go after people offline all the time.
Yeah.
All
isn't time. It called like doxing or something?
Doxing yeah. and swatting, if they really want to take it real far.
Swatting, yeah. swatting is nuts. I don't know.
It's so insane.
I don't know that I would get swatted because that's big. I mean, that's literally big guns. But like, yeah, I don't want somebody poking around in my personal, honest to God, real life.
Oh, sure.
It's
scary.
How I feel about it.
Yeah. Especially if you have kids. What a terrifying thing that would be. Again, I'm a single dude. Right? I mean, yeah. I got a lot of leeway here to be able to say and act however I want to. I couldn't imagine if I had children and someone tried to get into my personal life. What a terrifying thing.
Issue number 3. So this week I read a Tumblr article from a person named Reynard Foe, and they brought up the topic of the fact that any company that's looking for submissions should pay the artist to do said submissions. So pretty much the idea is, oh, if you want to work for DC and you want to give DC samples, DC should pay you to do those samples. He wrote up a very impassioned Tumblr piece about this. It was kind of passed around the internet a little bit. I had read it. Dwayne had passed it along to us originally, and I could not disagree more. But before I get into the conversation, we've actually reached out also to try to have him on the show and discuss this openly, but we haven't heard anything back as of yet. But it's still recent, still could happen. And Mr. Foe has the right to his opinion, obviously. I just kind of don't agree with it, and I have my reasons for it. But first, what do you guys think?
It sounds, I don't know. I'm kind of torn on like it. Like it's just the way it's always been. I mean, I'm not an artist, so I don't know how it works for you guys. But it just seems like you always, yeah, you do sample pitch. You're always people looking for sample scripts from Marvel and DC so they could take them to portfolio reviews and show them and that kind of stuff. Kind of like an audition, as it were, for a job. But then you always have the argument about doing something for exposure. You should never work for free. That was a whole conversation that was a few months ago that was dominant on social media, that you should never do art for free. You should always be trying to make money on it because it's your time and your, you know, it's your livelihood. So I think you should. It's, you're auditioning. It's like, you know, expecting a movie or a TV show or whatever producers to pay you to audition. That doesn't happen. Everyone has to audition. This medium just happens to be art and not a thespian type thing. So you have to put a little bit out there for free. You have to put it out. And that's my opinion. I could be wrong.
Let me just read to you guys one little snippet of it, okay? Mm-hmm. If you're a Marvel or DC company like Boom that profits off of large licenses, you should pay for the samples from prospective contractors. The hours an artist spends making the sample are bankable hours. It is work. By not paying for that sample art, these corporations are offsetting the cost of their R&D on labor. Artists shouldn't have to shoulder the burden of a corporation's R&D. But how do you know if the artist is appropriate for that book? If that's what you're asking for a sample, you're already interested enough to pay for that sample. Should artists pay to waylay the risk that an editor or whomever solicits the sample isn't qualified to shrewdly select prospective artists for a property? If you can't afford for the samples, maybe drop one of the dozen Batman books you're putting out and put that money towards your R&D. So now, like Dwayne said, it's an audition, right?
Right.
And
it's a requested audition. Is that what I'm understanding? So basically, they're saying, we like some of your work. We'd like to see you draw up these pages as we would have you draw them for a job to see if it works for us. Is that kind of what I'm getting here?
Yeah, Ron. The original like take on this is that he did not give out any names. He sure. knew somebody who was a professional artist working in the industry for, I think it was about 5 or 7 years, maybe more. And then the person was contacted or had a meeting with a young up-and-coming DC editor. And that editor said, oh, maybe I'd like to see you on this book or that book, but I'd have to see really your take on that character. Then the person did samples, and I don't think any work came of it.
Sure.
So, okay. You know, I mean, I understand how this is maybe one step further or maybe two steps further than the normal person who's not already considered a professional and they already have a body of work that they then could – show to people to kind of stand up for them and be their resume. This is someone who has that and was in a meeting and did something to kind of maybe go the extra step to get that job. Now, yeah. I don't know what you guys, I hear, Dwayne, I think you made a really good point for it. It's an audition. Mm-hmm. I think that no matter what, unless you are in a very, very high level of the comics industry, I don't think anyone is above doing a sample sketch, a sample page for someone else. Now, I'm not saying draw a sample book, But I don't think it's ridiculous to say, hey, I don't know how you would draw the Flash. Can I see how you would draw the Flash? Or, you know, let me see a page or two so I can see how you would do it. I like your style on Swamp Thing, but I might not like it on the Flash. But, you know, you are a good storyteller. I don't think it's too far-fetched. But I do understand the basis of the overall question, right? I mean, I don't think there's any I don't think there's any ill will that this person's trying to wish on people. But I think at the same time, an artist's time is valuable.
If Marvel was in any way, or whoever, DC, or Dark Horse, or if they were in any way profiting off of these, like if they would then take this art in and then in somehow use it, I would 100% agree with the guy. But again, if they're not, if this is just, as you guys are saying, it really sounds like an audition process. I mean, I've done this. I put portfolio work up. I put a huge amount of money into my video work, into my web hosting, and into getting my stuff out in front of people. It's part of the job. It is expected cost. It's why you get to write it off on your taxes. I mean, I absolutely see where he's coming from, where he wants to put more control in the creators, but how many creators get that money? How much money do they get? What's the cost? Do some get more? Do some get less? I mean, I don't see how that's even a feasible thing, really. And honestly, again, as we talked earlier, it's not like there's a huge profit margin here. Sure, in the movies there is now, but I don't think in the books that profit margin exists as much as people think it does.
Yeah, there's not. I think what people are seeing is that Avengers makes $1 billion. Batman, right. Superman makes $800 million. They must be, you know, Scrooge McDucking it over there, diving in their money vaults and swimming around. And it's like, no, that's separate. We're like the little stepbrother in the corner, drawn with their crayons. We're not the big movie company thing. It's like we're not near that kind of money. And Joe, I don't know. I mean, I don't know how much you know about the sampling thing. They're not asking for like a 22-page comic. They're asking for what, like, right, maybe like a scene, like 3 or 4 pages?
I would say that at most. You know what I mean? Like 3 or 4 pages, probably from a professional artist, that's probably a good an at most ask, because you do know, like, if it's someone that you know has a body of work, then, you know, you can go in and say, okay, what's your timeline? Like, if someone asks me, how much time is it for an issue? And I say, well, I ask at least 6 weeks. I can deliver under it, but then I'm not happy with the work and you won't be happy with the work. So 6 weeks is a comfortable deadline for me. And then I'll always get it in beforehand, but at least I have that time to ask.
Like,
you imagine if a you know, and I'm going to pick an artist that I love, Art Adams, right? I've been on the show and I've said how I love Art Adams' artwork, or Frank Quietly, or whatever. If you go to that level where you're all the way at the top, maybe you never have to do those kind of things. But if you're at the B and C and D and E and, you know, levels, you have to. You're still in a pit fighting to get notoriety, fighting to get that one thing that's going to help you. And Aram brought up a gigantically huge point. This is not something that they're using for publication. This is something that they're using for verification to see if you can do the book in the way they see it, right? Like the editor is trying to make the best book they can. They're trying to get the most qualified people, or the people that fit the best within a style. So, you know, I don't think you can expect to be paid for an audition that's going to either get you that job, which will then be paying you something, or, you know, hopefully get you something down the line. Like, okay, maybe you don't work out for the Flash, but maybe you do work out for Green Arrow. You know what I mean? Like, if you're thinking of it as a failure because you don't get that one thing that you put in samples for, that's a negative way of thinking, because I know plenty of guys who have put in samples for a book with the big 2 or 3 or big 4 companies, and then it didn't work out on one thing, worked out on another. Like, it's all part of the kind of game you have to play to be a professional comic creator.
There's a specific set of power dynamics that needs to be acknowledged too. You need to acknowledge and accept that everyone who draws comic art would like to be drawing their favorite character. And a lot of people's favorite characters are housed at Marvel and DC. And it's the competition sets the price. And if there's a guy who's willing to do it for free and you're not, you're going to lose the opportunity. Does that make sense?
It definitely makes sense, that huge amount of competition. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And I just don't think that you... It would be great if they decided that was going to be the industry standard, but if there are people who are willing to do it without requiring compensation, they're always going to have a competitive edge.
Well, yeah, it's like we always say, this is, it's a business, and that's what it comes down to. I send out, I need a new Green Lantern artist, I'm going to go, okay, I reach out to 20 people, and 10 of them want to be paid and 10 don't, well, let me look at these first 10 that are doing it for free, and I'll probably find someone good enough out of this 10. I'm not going to bother with, you may be better, but if you're going to, you know, ask me for a price, I can get it for free. Businesses are going to go where the money or the lack of money would be in that situation.
Yeah.
Well, the lack of cost would be.
Yeah. Cost of money. Yeah. So, I mean, is there, I mean, I just, I can't see, like, I've read the thing and Eric Larson made some good points back at him about how basically we were saying it's an audition. That's the way you do. You put your time in. I just can't see it ever becoming a norm where someone would pay for sample pages. I mean, it boggles my mind. Like, as an,
it would be ethically correct.
Yeah.
It would be, I mean, it would be a nice way to show people that art is not something you just ask a friend to do, mm-hmm. which, sure. you know, I get a lot of, but.
Right. And they plan to use that art for something.
Right.
That's the core difference. Yeah. That's the core difference where they're not valuing the thing. I don't think Marvel doesn't. I don't think they don't value these things. As you were saying, they keep them on hand. They'll refer back to them. They'll look at this as a valuable portfolio piece where they can refer to again and again and maybe call you up for a different project. So there's value placed in these. It's not like they're just casting them aside, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't see how it's, I mean, I would submit my portfolio for anything. If you're an actor, you got to go sit in the hallway for 2 hours. There's a cost to everything you do. You have
and
to
I,
assume
I think
some
that,
of that.
Like, it's another situation where it's just a very basic economic principle. Like,
yeah.
Does the cost of doing that sample page, you know, outweigh the benefit of getting the job? And no, I don't think it does.
Isn't it, what do we say, like sweat equity?
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
It's mm-hmm. sweat equity. I think that, you know, if you expect your talent to be off the bat completely financially reimbursed, then, you know, you're not going to continue to push. Like, if you think that just because you've been Hamlet, do you think that you can go get that coffee commercial? No, you still need to audition for that coffee commercial, regardless of the fact that you played Hamlet for 2 years on Broadway. Like, it doesn't connect. One job going to the next is going to have some, you know, like, yeah, again, you're top tier. You're not going to probably have to do that. They're going to be coming after you. But I mean, even when you get into the job, like you said about the movies before, right? Like, Mark Millar pretty much did Civil War, but Civil War was different from the movie, from the book, but he's not seeing anything from that. Mm-hmm. From that thing, right? Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, he did the job. He moved on. He got paid well for the job. He moved on. He did something else. Like, you know, I'll hear people say that too. Like, oh, he should get way more for that. Well, I'm sure if he has a royalty deal, he does. But, you know, that's not what the job is. The job is draw this book or you know, draw right. these samples to get this book. Like, mm-hmm. you have to be logistical and honestly common sense focused on what your return rate is going to be. Like, maybe you're going to get something in the future. Maybe you'll get that job now, but you know, it's kind of part of the business, man. It's kind of, you know, the best way I can say it is sweat equity. Sweat equity is hopefully gets you places in the future.
You're an unknown commodity without doing that. How can you possibly expect? I mean, like, there are people who go into doing whole books with friends without getting paid. Like, you know, there are low-level creators who will put in the time, you know, without having any payment up front just to see the book done. And it's just, yeah, I wish that there was more of a premium that, you know, the world at large recognized the greatness of comic artists and wanted to see them fairly compensated. But hell, we can't get teachers fairly compensated. Mm-hmm. And, like, you just have to work for it. It's competitive. Everyone wants to do it. And as long as some people are willing to do it for free, I don't see how you can say, like, oh, you shouldn't, though. You should be above that.
Now, I don't know if this is how it works, but as an artist, wouldn't it be prudent to have on your portfolio sample pages of these characters? Would it behoove you to have a Superman page, a Spider-Man page, just already in existence? So if someone comes across your thing, they go, oh, that's his Spider-Man. That way you don't necessarily have to do a spec page. Would that nip it in the bud by just, you're going to do a portfolio anyway as an artist. Why not try to do as much to show them that you can do their characters? Does that not make sense?
If you're not sitting down and drawing every day for free to practice.
Yep.
And you want to be an artist, there's a problem.
I was going to say, so why not already build some of those pages? If you know, if your dream is to do Spider-Man or to do something at Marvel, why not already craft two-page stories or whatever, find scripts, do two pages so they can see your storytelling of X-Men, of Doom Patrol, or of whatever, and just have those already there. And then, as like Sam says, you're always drawing. As you're doing better stuff, move out the old, bring in some new stuff, and always have it there. Would that be useful? I mean, I assume it does in my writer brain.
I can't imagine it would hurt, but but in this process, it kind of sounds like, I'm imagining anyway, that half of this is how do you work with our writer? So I think that, yeah, I would imagine that part of that would be like, this is the writing. How do you interpret it? So they want to see how that process goes, because that's a very important handshake. But otherwise than that, I mean, I can't imagine where it ever hurt to draw more and more of what you want to do.
Final issue. If you've listened to God's Fall or you just listen to me talk, you know I'm a big fan of superhero, and God's Fall is a superhero story set in a fantasy setting. And that is probably one of the big things that drew me into it, was that I am a huge, huge fan of cape and cowls. I mean, I try to read as many comics as I can and try to, different things, but I always end up going back to men in spandex, punching men in spandex. I don't know what that says about me, but that's what I seem to be into. And I keep going back to that, and just God's Fall was seeing those tropes in a different setting. And I thought it'd be a cool conversation to see how we can apply it to different things. And like, Aram, what made you go with God's Fall being basically fantasy superheroes?
Well, I wanted a method to put the gods' power separate from everything else. Like, I want it to be separate from magic. I want it to be separate from psionics. I just wanted it to feel different. And superpowers just seemed like a way to do that, like a really interesting way to kind of tackle the idea of gods within a fantasy setting, because superheroes are our modern day gods. They're our modern day pantheon. So I wanted just to take that idea and just directly drop it into a typical 13th century-esque D&D setting.
So, I mean, yeah, it's a fascinating idea, and I guess it could apply to other things. I mean, if you are just like, as we said, we always try to reach out to other creators and stuff on this, that if you are like, I really like superheroes, or I really like sci-fi, I really like fantasy, maybe trying to stretch out and going your superhero into a fantasy, doing your superhero, but setting it somewhere else, doing a superhero sci-fi combination. There are so many possibilities out there. It's just, you really shouldn't limit yourself. So, I mean, do you guys have any favorite ones or any other ideas you think kind of do that whole peanut butter and chocolate type combination?
Cowboy superheroes.
Cowboy superheroes.
Yes. I started a book a while back. It was one of my it was a time travel cowboy superhero thing, and I love the idea of putting superpowers in the Wild West. I just think it's amazing. I want that to happen somewhere. And I mean, yeah, it has. There's like what ifs and whatever, but no, I think cowboy superheroes. It's because it's lawless. And there was so much vigilante stuff happening. I think it could be really cool to see the vigilantes like selected by superpower.
That's awesome.
So I love that idea. It's one I keep coming back to and kind of can't put down, because like when I hear vigilante, I think superhero and I think Wild West, and I just want to see it happen. So that's definitely a thing that I get excited about. But
now I'm excited about that. That sounds awesome.
Exactly. And now I'm thinking of superhero pirates.
Oh my god!
Yes. Dude, I'm not even joking. I'm like, oh my god, super pirates!
Right?
We are sitting on again the final issue podcast. Just, you lucky listening motherfuckers! You are getting gold. Whoever mines this gold?
I tell you, we should check Kickstarter in a couple months to see who's taking our ideas and running with them. Yeah.
If Doug from our show hears this and he hears superhero pirate, he's going to come bursting out of his room, because his character is basically based on Luffy from One Shot, so he's already superhero pirate. You know,
This is for you, Doug, right there.
Yeah, exactly.
So, well, Dwayne, just for the framing of the question, are you asking where we've seen it? Do we like it?
Just kind of say a general thing. I'm kind of open to anywhere the conversation goes. But like, if you've seen anything that stuck out in your mind that was like an unexpected trope blend.
Absolutely. To me, the one that shocked me the most, at least early on, was I think maybe Spider-Man had come out. Definitely the early Batman had come out with Keaton. Not the Nolan, what's his name? Christian Bale one.
Yeah.
But I remember seeing Unbreakable.
Yes.
Being like, oh my God, I can't keep watching this slow moving thing. And then, oh my God. And then all of a sudden, oh, there's a comic book store. Oh, there's this. Oh, Samuel L. Jackson gives him that speech where I think you're the opposite of me. I think you're a superhero. And man, that was like one of my favorite movies for like years.
Yes, yes, yes.
Like mm-hmm. I still watch that movie and I still remember the reverence for the fact of like, I bought the DVD. I don't know if it was a Blu-ray, but I bought a DVD where like, you know, M. Night Shyamalan went into the whole fact of how he collected comics. And there was just, it was just right before like the, maybe the Singer X-Men came out, but it definitely wasn't the boom of superhero movies.
No, it was definitely at the front of the curve.
Absolutely. Yeah, man, it was that story was so tight that I was like, oh God, and Waters' his weakness, and it just blended it in such a human way that I was like, oh, this is so, so good.
Yeah. There is a shot. I'm so sorry, but there is a shot in this movie. And if you're in the theater, man, this is why you go to the theater. When his kid is loading up more and more weights on him, right? Mm. And it's loading him up and loading him up. And he's just testing the outer limits of his strength. And his kid has really loaded him up at the last one. And the camera goes down when the weights go into his chest and then pulls back up. And it's like he's pushing up the whole audience. It's just such an amazing shot. I love that movie, and it's a perfect example.
And if you think around all you guys, if you think of that scene, like he yells at his son because his son overheard Samuel L. Jackson's Mr. Glass character saying, "I think you're a superhero." Yep. So his son kind of starts believing it, right? Mm-hmm. So his son like loads up like, you know, all these things, and he goes, "Take it off, take it all off. I could have been hurt." And then he goes, "Okay, how much was it that time?" And he goes, "I put it all on."
Yeah.
And then you pull back and you're like, oh my God. And then, you know,
like I think weights like and duck- paint cans.
Yeah, and paint cans.
Yeah. Random paint shit. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's definitely one of my favorite. And that's like, yeah, that's like one of the first superheroes in the real world type thing. It was grounded in very reality with a splash of superhero, which is.
Why can't he make movies like that anymore? What? Because
he ran out of ideas and he got so hooked on the twist. It was the twist. Yeah. He had that gut punch moment, that stupid with the trees and Zoe Deschanel. I don't even remember what it was.
Don't start me with the plant movie.
Oh my God, the plant movie. Why? No, he just was like, I have to punch him in the gut. They can never see it coming. I'm just gonna have to choose stupid or twist. Not the right decision.
No, because Unbreakable is such. I mean, as you're saying, it is a solid piece of work from beginning to end. Man, everything ties in, and then just, you know, the Lady in the Water, like what the hell happened?
Even tried to like Lady in the Water. Like I went in with such an open mind and I was on board. And then I was like, this is just about you.
Yeah.
You know, like this is not for anyone but you.
The storytelling got lazy. We're way off track.
We're discussing how M. Night Shyamalan disappointed us.
He peaked when he had Bruce Willis's character go into the pool. It looked like he was going to drown because the superhero was in his one kryptonite, his weakness. And then all of a sudden, the lady who he rescues pulls him out. And then in total, complete Superman superhero mode, he is knees on the ground, hands on the ground, and he stands up. And the music and the score hit the crescendo. And you're like, Bruce Willis is Superman. Or he is like this hero. And
it
I remember getting
there in front of you. It's oh God, magical.
Right. That's a great way of describing it. It was magical. I got chills. I was like, I'm seeing the start of a superhero franchise that I didn't know was a superhero franchise. Like, oh my God, the greatest con is pulled on me coming to this thing thinking it's going to be Sixth Sense like, and it's not. And oh man, that movie, I'm going to go watch it again. I don't even know why we're still talking to each other. Let's just all go watch Unbreakable. Let's rip crack it.
Next episode.
It would just be me going, oh, that was so masterful. Oh, that was so well done. I mean, it wouldn't be a terribly interesting riff track.
It would just be like, oh, the whole time. Like, oh, I see what he did there. It's so good. It's so smart.
But hold on. So I know. What was after that? Then he did Signs?
Was it
Signs? Yeah, I think it was Signs. And it was Signs was not offensive. It got a little weird. But it was not
Wing
a offensive.
Merrill.
Other... Yeah.
Wing Away Merrill, that worked. And it was The Village that was the start of the end, wasn't it?
Yeah.
The Village, I called The Village, and that's when I got upset with him. Because, like, we were 5 minutes in, and they showed a tombstone or something, and I was like, that's not right. And then I noticed that all the people had on, like, double-breasted suits with buttons, And I was like, that's not right. And so I was like, this is modern interpretation. I was like, either they had the worst wardrobe department in the world or that's the twist.
Or he doesn't pay attention to those things for some reason, which would seem bizarre.
No, he put it in on purpose because he was trying to make it. I guarantee you that was it was intentional.
Sure. Yeah.
So like make you look back and be like, he knew all along. Yeah. But I was like, either worst wardrobe ever or that's what this is. And it was what it was. At that moment, I was like, he's done. He's done because he's hooked on the twist and he's not doing it right anymore. Oh,
And by the way, right after the village, it was Lady in the Water and then The Happening and then The Last Airbender.
Which is the death. I think that may have the worst reviews of any movie on Rotten Tomatoes, actually.
It deserves them.
Yeah, I've never seen it. I was like, I'm not going to make myself hurt all over.
It's amazing how you can take such a wealth of information and ruin it. But that's actually a perfect example. That's a good time because The Last Airbender is a great example of a superhero style aesthetic that was pushed into a different world, I think. I think that's an excellent example, actually.
Yeah, I would agree with you. A lot of fantasy does rely on like two character or, you know, like a set of characters that have supernatural abilities. I don't think but they're usually a certain type. Like, I mean, you have wizards or you have, you know, like whatever, there is that element of like a little bit more than human. And that runs really strong in fantasy and sci-fi. We just don't think of them as superheroes.
Yeah.
Because it's magic, I guess. Is that what it is?
Maybe. I mean, because if you look at in sci-fi, there's many characters that could be considered superheroes.
Right.
You know, I mean, when you look at, I guess, Guardians of the Galaxy, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, they're superheroes, but are they? Are they just aliens and this is what they can do because they're aliens? Are they superheroes? Are they like what exactly are they?
Where do you draw do they have to be fighting for the greater good?
Do they have to have a cape?
Cape is not necessary. I've seen
I mean, RoboCop is a superhero, right? Because he's pretty much, you know, a crippled Iron Man thrown into a suit, right? Like,
yes,
it's just about the character pretty much deciding to be a force of good and to fight the forces of evil, right? Like, Twain, this is your question. You got to frame it for yourself.
I'm just lost in the M. Night Shyamalan of it all. But
we got Shyamalan quicksand. We did. We're out now.
See, we just had a Shyamalan plot twist right there. No one was expecting Shyamalan.
The Shyamalan phenomenon. I made that rhyme. I get a prize.
No, I just I guess it kind of goes to, like I said, with Godfall using superheroes in a different way. And then as you guys were talking and talking about Unbreakable, my mind kind of went to the place of using superheroes in more than just good guy punch bad guy type thing. Like with what I did with Arrow Girl, it's a superhero story. You got super gorillas, jetpacks, all that kind of stuff. But in the crux of it, it was a story of something else where I could have taken out all the superhero stuff and just told the story of a girl losing her father. And I think the story would have got across. I just used a more colorful setting. So I guess in my head, it's like how we could use superheroes in so many ways other than just the popcorn movie version that everyone thinks about when they think of superheroes.
Yeah. Right. And I think I think I've said this before, but like that's the beauty of sci-fi and fantasy is that you can address really contentious social problems in a way that like just completely makes it metaphor. And you can add so much subtext with those genres specifically because you take it out of our world and you create, you know, I'm losing my word, an analog. You create an analog for whatever is, you know, whatever forces you want to deal with. And in that way, you have things like, you know, Ian McKellen and Bryan Singer coming years later and be like, oh yeah, by the way, that whole X-Men franchise that everyone loved, that's a coming out story or whatever. And like people can digest it and empathize in a way that they wouldn't if it was put to them in black and white. And that's sort of the beauty of this otherworldly power.
What was the movie, and I'm using a lot of movies as examples, but I'm sure there's other TV shows, like there's Heroes, right? Like that was a big one where...
Mm-hmm. Oh, I loved Heroes. The first season.
The first season.
Everyone loved the first season.
And then it was like, ooh, wow, what the hell happened?
Oh, you can ruin it. I didn't know.
Oh, well done. That was impressive.
Yeah, it was impressive how bad it went so quickly. Yeah, kudos on that.
That's like a plane crashing while it hasn't taken off, and yet it's like 10,000 feet into the earth.
Yeah,
you guys really pushed it. But what was that movie where the kids found a rock and they all kind of touched it and then a few of them got like powers?
Oh, Chronicle?
Oh,
Chronicle.
Super 8? Yeah. Oh, no, I'm thinking that Super 8 was not that great.
No, but Chronicle was.
Yeah, Chronicle was pretty great.
I don't even know what that is.
Oh, it's the good movie Trank made before Fantastic Four.
Okay, I've not seen this. Oh, okay, yes, I remember. I've not seen it.
It was kind of found footage type superhero stuff.
Yeah, that's cool. That's a cool idea. I was trying to think of like way superheroes outside of specific genre. And there was a British show, and I cannot remember the name of it.
What, Misfits?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. That's great.
Misfit was fun. Well, that's another one where they kind of jumped the shark early on. Yeah, but man, is it just not sustainable? Can you only do like a couple of seasons? Like
I really, really liked the one Sci-Fi had. It was a smaller, low budget thing.
Alphas?
Yes, I loved Alphas.
Why do I know all this stuff?
I really enjoyed that.
I really liked
how they were exploring it with very singular, very smaller kind of powers that gave them edges, but not really like giant things. I thought that was a very grounded superhero show, and I really liked that one.
I've not seen that one.
It's really good. I think there's like two seasons.
Two seasons, and it ends on a cliffhanger. So
yeah, of course.
Is the new question, can you not do more than two seasons?
Yeah.
Like, is it just not possible? Do superheroes just need to be rebooted after that long? Like,
no, Sam, I'm going to tell you what the problem is. It's called the Superman theory, where the powers become more than the person.
Yep.
It's all about the human, like all the things we're talking about is the humanity. It's the humanity of Bruce Willis's character in the now seminal movie of our lifetime, Unbreakable.
yep.
That's what drags you in. That's what drags people into Batman. That's what repels people now from Superman.
Yep.
Superman, okay, we've turned him into blue electricity. We've turned him into this new thing that he has some sort of super fucking power sneeze where he can blow his load all out and knock everyone out. But then all of a sudden he's human for like a day. There's this thing with Superman where they just can't get to the humanity of him.
Yep.
Well, he's not a human.
Yeah, right. Well, you could still get to the alien story of him, I think.
And you can get to the humanity of Superman. One of the best panels, I mean, I've ever seen is the one where he intervenes in that in that girl's suicide.
Well, that was All-Star Superman, right? That was the best story I've ever seen.
Yeah, that's the exception to the Superman rule right there.
That's just the point. It's doable. You're
right.
Yeah, I mean, and if you remember that it's his greatest weakness isn't kryptonite. His greatest weakness is his humanity. It's his core center. If you get that right, Superman's amazing. But you're right. You gotta write the person.
That's where these other shows go off.
Yep.
Epic conflict. You have to have him in a, like, it has to, I don't know. I love the first few issues of that. God, was it Greg Pak? Batman Superman that came out like a couple of years ago.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And, anyway, I loved that. And I thought that their version of Superman was very low key and approachable. And I liked that Superman. I've never found one that I connected with, but I've never tried that hard.
All-Star Superman is the absolute foundation that's kind of built on to me.
Yeah. Yeah.
I would agree.
It's the same thing with the movies. Why Christopher Reeves and that Richard Donner film, Matt, like, just works better than kind of any other iteration that they've tried. Because there's just something that I think people can't connect with. Like, it's Superman. Like, there's something about the way Grant Morrison got the interconnectivity of his powers, his relationship with other people, his want to have a regular job and want to be a regular person. Like,
yeah,
there was just something very magical, and Quietly's artwork obviously sold that beautifully. But yeah, maybe not to just call it my Superman problem, but I think with all these shows that we talk about that try to use and mold the superhero thing, once you make the power the problem more than the person the problem, there becomes an issue where you're just trying to do sci-fi, you're just trying to do big budget stuff, and you're not really relating to the story. I think that's why Heroes, the first season, works so well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it was about the people. It was very, very much about the people and their fear and their confusion. And then once it just became about the powers, it could be anything. You're absolutely right. It became 2D.
And they also added too many characters. I mean, that's just a flat. Yeah. It's just was too hard to follow. And that's something a lot of superhero genre shows kind of fall into, because it's like, oh, and we could have a character who could.
Yeah.
And you just, the possibilities are literally limitless, but people's attention spans are not, and focus becomes a problem.
Well, let me ask you guys a question about, and this is kind of on the topic, hopefully. I had a comic shop chat about this like a few weeks ago, whereas it was really more out of a Batman Superman the movie conversation, mm-hmm. Which I at the time had not seen. Now I have, and oof. But anyway.
I won't see it. I don't want to know. I don't want to know how bad it is.
And I went deep on the extended cut, too. And yeah, I will say this.
If you can cut out Wonder Woman for like the 2.5 minutes, flawless. Watch all those.
Dude, I could not agree more. When she screams, puts up her sword, and just launches herself towards Doomsday, I'm like, oh my God, she's awesome. It made almost the whole movie worthwhile.
I was sold when she got hit by the force of two locomotives slamming into each other, got knocked a mile out of combat, and then just smiles like, all right, this is a good time, and then picks up her sword. Yeah, that was amazing.
Yeah, I said Batman and Wonder Woman to me. Wonder Woman was probably the star of the whole movie, because she actually acted. You didn't know her motives. You didn't know what was going on. That, like, and this goes to my point. So why does everyone like Batman more than Superman, right? And let's just say, for the sake of this topic, a lot of times the other media pick up the superpowers very much based off of comic book tropes, right? It's like a retelling of a Superman, a Batman, an X-Men, or something like that, right?
Yeah.
So the thesis that the comic shop professors came to was that it comes down to mystery. If mystery is a core part of something, if mystery could be applied, then the character has more longevity that more people can kind of get into. Batman's a detective. There's always a mystery going on. You know, like Court of Owls. Who's behind it? There's always a mystery. Mm-hmm. With Superman, it's not always about a mystery. It's just about what superheroic act is he going to do to save people? What superpower is he going to do? How is he going to defy odds? Whereas there's really no mystery.
Right.
He's going to do the right thing. He's going to be confronted with a bad thing. He's going to continue to do the right thing, and then he's going to bust out a cool move.
Yeah.
Right. No mystery.
That's basically it.
So. Yeah, he's too much of a Boy Scout. Like, he doesn't have any darkness.
No.
Right. Well, I'm saying, like, why did heroes work? The mystery of where these powers come. What, like, you're going along for the story. What is this?
But with Batman, there's not even the superhero element. Batman's, I mean, like, you know, I love Batman. Batman's not a superhero. Batman's a guy in a suit. Like, and that, I think, it has a lot to do with it, too. It's the human factor. It's the idea that that guy you know who's never around at night, he could be Batman. Like, he's a really good guy, and he's, like, really buff or whatever, and he could totally be Batman. It's the idea that he can exist in this world. We don't have to suspend disbelief to a degree that we are uncomfortable with.
Sylvester Stallone, Bruce Lee, and Sherlock Holmes love child.
Yes.
Put into a, you know.
In leather. For God's sake. Yeah, come lots on. Of
it. Layers of leather.
So yeah, I guess what we're kind of all getting at here is that the superhero, that what we like about the superhero, the good overcoming evil, there's so much more to it than just, like me, like always the fan of this, like I was saying, the tights and stuff. What makes the good superhero, whether you put it in fantasy, whether you put it in the Wild West, whether they're pirates, whether they're, I don't know, on the moon somewhere, it's the core of the character, the core of the story you're trying to tell. So if you're trying to tell a superhero, quote-unquote, story, you need, that should be the dress, and that shouldn't be the steak of your story. That should be the potato and vegetables on the side. Your meteor story should not just be, hey, cool superpowers.
Right. And there's a lot of fun things to do within that. There's a lot of fun ways to mix and match superpowers and see how they play off each other and find different core mechanics to tell interesting stories. But if you don't care about the people, who gives a fuck? Who gives a fuck? It's just a bunch of flashy things and lights going off otherwise.
All style and no substance. And that makes a story a dull boy. But it's just like when I think about pairing superpowers, like how much do you love the idea of Wolverine and Magneto? And that's not just because of metal and Magneto. That's because of the diametrically opposed personalities. They could not be more different. And they're still both kind of gray, but like that, there are so many possibilities, but it's not just because of the way their powers work. It's because of the way the people work.
And how the relationship is in between them. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. That said, though, one of the characters in my game, Automail, literally exists because I was like, what if the Arrow and the Flash were the same person? And that's like, you know, so that's all of the birth of that character.
Full on amalgam right there.
Yeah, basically.
Nice.
You've been listening to the Final Issue Podcast. On behalf of the panel, I want to say thanks for joining us. If you are enjoying the show, don't forget to subscribe to the Final Issue on iTunes and leave us a constructive review. And if you'd like to suggest an issue for discussion in a future show, send us an email at finalissuepodcast@gmail.com or via Twitter at finalissuepod.
Looking for more great episodes? Head over to box.com/FIP for our archive.
Yeah, that got dark.
Well, we are
a lot of things do here.
Yeah, we have laughs and giggles, and all of a sudden we make that sharp left into like shit just got real.
Yeah. Hi, everyone listening. Hug your children.
Exactly. Hug your kids.
The trolls are coming for your children. Hide them away.
Watch what you put on Twitter. Someone's gonna steal your kids.
God, sorry about that. I don't know how the hell that got so dark.
Hey, that's the internet, man.
I bring that out in people.